I want to welcome you to another lesson in the Lead Yourself First program. My name is Tom Cooper. I'm so glad you've joined me for today's lesson. Today, we're talking about connecting with people at work. Lead Yourself First is your personal growth program. As Zig Ziglar said, you can have anything you want in life if you help enough other people get what they want. And Lead Yourself First is your system to help you find and start using those tools that are going to help you get help you as you help others get what they want. And that will help you get what you want. I work hard to make sure each of these lessons is able to stand on its own, that each lesson contains practical and interesting, maybe even entertaining information, so you could take even one of these lessons and make that lesson a focus for a season of your life to help you develop mastery in a single area. Now, this lesson, like every lesson, is designed to bring you the best information, the best ideas that I can find on these topics, so that you can use what we talk about to get you better results. This program is designed to help you move up the ladder, to gain influence and gain respect among your team members and your leaders, to help you be seen as a catalyst and make good things happen for the team. I believe in you. I believe in your dream to grow. I know there's a ton of potential locked inside you that could be unlocked to deliver great results. Lead Yourself First is based on the idea that each player on the team has the ability to stretch and grow. And if you'll start right where you are, you'll be amazed at what you can create in your life. Now, before we jump into this lesson, you know I always ask, how will you act after this lesson's over? Apply. What's an idea you can apply? That's what the A stands for in ACT. What's something you can use? C, change. I'm doing it one way. I'm going to change and do it a different way. Or T, teach. What can you take from this lesson and share with somebody else? You want to be a river, not a reservoir. You want to share these ideas as you're learning them with other people. You don't have to be the person who stands in front of the room to do the teaching. Now, I've been looking forward to today's lesson, and I look forward to it because I have learned through painful personal experience what happens when we overlook the human side of work. And I look forward to it because I know that if I can leave you with just a few key ideas and you use them, you're going to be able to achieve in weeks what it took me years to do. In the next few minutes, we're going to be unpacking some gold when it comes to dealing with people. And if you'll just take one idea and put it into practice for the next month, you'll be shocked. And now, for you, you're going to want to dig into tools and accountability about putting this into practice. And if that's you, at the end of the lesson, I'm going to share with you a way to do that. Fair enough? You might be surprised to learn that 87% of your success at work has to do with people skills. 87%. If you're not investing in your connection with other people, I guarantee it is going to harm your effectiveness. Now, today's lesson, we're going to cover 3 points. One, human connection is the heart of all productive work. Human connection is the heart of all productive work. Two, people work is the work. It is the work. Tasks are secondary. Number three, I'm going to share with you 6 ways to make a connection with other people. Now, I'll tell you, I work with senior leaders in organizations all the time. And if there's one thing I hear most often, it's why can't people just do their jobs? Why can't people do their jobs? The answer may be uncomfortable, but the answer is it's because we don't value them highly enough to invest in them or even to invest in ourselves. And regardless of your position or your role or your title, you've got the ability to make a difference in the lives of the people you work with. If you can communicate value to others, you will find that they are more willing to deliver for you. I have a confession to make. I'm an extrovert, but man, do I love getting tasks knocked out. It gives me great joy to take something that was on my to-do list and mark it off my to-do list. Conversely, it's kind of a gut punch to me when I think something is done and it turns out to not be done and it goes right back on the to-do list. It's very painful for me. And I love getting stuff done so much that, well, it often gets in the way of my relationships with other people. I can recall to my embarrassment how many times I've been in a situation where I've focused so much on getting stuff done that I've stomped on other people. And the bigger problem with this is that studies show that the people stuff is more important than the tasks. Human connection is the heart of all productive work. I found that when I invested in connecting with my team members, it dramatically improved my effectiveness. When I focused on checking tasks off my task list and ignored the personness of the people on my team, my productivity plummeted. When I took care of my people, they took care of the tasks, and everybody was more productive and happier. Kindness is valuable. Now, you may have some outdoor clothing that's made of polar tech or polar fleece. Now, the company that makes these materials is called Malden Mills, and the owner of that company is a deeply religious man named Aaron Feierstein. On December 31st, 1995, his factory caught fire and burned to the ground. The factory employed 3,400 workers, and it was the main employer for two neighboring towns. The area once had many mills, but most had closed and moved to areas where they could pay people less money to work. And Mr. Feierstein felt that people should be paid a decent wage, and so he would not move his factory. The fire occurred on his 70th birthday. The workers believed it was the end of the line for their jobs. Surely Mr. Feierstein would take the $300 million in insurance money and call it quits. While the smoke was still rising from the charred remains of the fire, Mr. Feierstein called his workers together at a school gymnasium and spoke with them. They were about to discover what kind of man they worked for. He announced he would not abandon them. He was going to rebuild the factory. He told them that he was keeping all 3,400 of them on the payroll for 1 month and that each would get a $275 Christmas bonus. Once the factory was rebuilt, they would get their jobs back. Grown men wept in the audience as he spoke. After the first month ended, he paid them for another month. After the second month ended, he paid them for a third month. It cost him $1.5 million a week to do this. He also paid their hospitalization insurance. His employees responded by salvaging what equipment they could and in temporary buildings got production up to what it was before the fire while the new factory was being built. Mr. Feierstein received much praise from around the country, but he said he only did what was the moral and right thing to do. He used his money to support his beliefs in God rather than make money his God. As each of you lives your life, try to remember Mr. Feierstein's example and treat people you encounter with fairness and with kindness. You'll be amazed at how good you feel and how much better you'll be treated in return. Mr. Feierstein values people over profits, and he's not alone. The research shows that nice guys get the best out of their subordinates. Of the 16,000 executive study, the 13% that were identified as high-performing executives tended to care about people as well as profits. They viewed their subordinates optimistically. They sought advice from the team, and they listened well. It's not that Feierstein didn't care about profits. It's that he valued people highly, and he was willing to sacrifice in the short term for long-term outcomes. That's something we can all consider. There's really good research data on how being people-focused can make a big difference in teamwork, in productivity, engagement, and morale. Building a positive work environment where we care about our team members, it pays. John Dewey said, "The deepest urge in human nature is the desire to be important." The deepest urge in human nature is the desire to be important. The desire to be important. This is such a big deal that most of Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, is focused on tools and techniques to address that very need in people. And in today's lesson, I want to share with you a few gems from Carnegie's book. This need to be valued by others often goes unmet. Many people going through life with this, they go through life with this need unmet, and it causes them to make choices that lead to bad outcomes. Thoreau said, "The mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation." Most people are unfulfilled, and they are longing for appreciation. Do you want to be a person who's able to get the most from other people? Learning to address this core need, it's going to give you a serious edge. William James said, "The deepest principle in human nature is the craving to be appreciated." Carnegie actually said, "Here is a gnawing and unfaltering human hunger, and the rare individual who honestly satisfies this heart hunger will hold people in the palm of his or her hand." What Carnegie's saying is, this need is so deep that it's in every person. And if you become that person who can satisfy that need in other people, those people will be totally committed to you. That is so deep. If you can honestly satisfy that heart hunger in other people, it'd be like holding those people in the palm of your hand. This has been proven true over and over and over again. One of the first employees in U.S. history to be paid over $1 million a year was a man by the name of Charles Schwab. Now, why was he paid that much? In 1921, that was an insane amount of money. Schwab said his salary was based on his ability to deal with people. He said, "I consider my ability to arouse enthusiasm among my people, the greatest asset I possessed, and the way to develop the best that is in a person is by appreciation and encouragement. There is nothing else that so kills the ambitions of a person as criticisms from superiors. Charles Schwab also said, in my wide association of life, meeting with many and great people in various parts of the world, I have yet to find a person who did not do better work and put forth greater effort under a spirit of approval rather than under a spirit of criticism. Kindness is valuable. It's so much more valuable and productive than criticism. I was about 19 years old, and I was working as a server in a restaurant, and there were several managers who oversaw operations, most of whom were not like Charles Schwab. I remember often hearing, if you got time to lean, you got time to clean, as if this was an inspirational message from on high. In general, I think I was a decent worker. I was polite. I showed up on time for work. I had happy customers almost all the time. I was decent at my job, and I had a decent reputation. Now, late one evening, a group of about 15 or 20 people was seated in my section of the restaurant, and I was scrambling for the next couple of hours to take their orders and refill drinks and make sure everybody at the table had everything they needed. And I was really busy all at once, and so I decided that I would take a shortcut. Now, typically, our procedure was that we were to clear the dishes as people were done with them and run them back to the dishwasher, and so as we delivered the appetizers or the entrees or the desserts or coffees. But this evening, I was tired. And I decided to set up a tray back in the server stand to pile my dishes. And over time, that stack of plates and cups and silverware got higher and higher and higher. And I would, over time, rearrange them so they were more efficiently stacked on the tray. By the time that group of people left, I collected my tip. Well, there was a veritable mountain of dishes piled high on that tray. It was definitely the biggest stack of dishes I had ever created in my time as a server. Now, at that point, I made another choice. Rather than carry the dirty dishes a little bit at once to the kitchen, I chose to try to lift the whole thing and make one single trip to the kitchen. It really was a continuation of my theme of cutting corners that evening. So why waste all that energy on those trips? I mean, and the restaurant management, they'd done everything they could to reduce waste. They had a wall-sized diagram next to the dishwashing station with an outline of each plate, cup, and saucer, and in bold print the price of each one. They wanted to reinforce to us why it was important not to lose or break or throw away any of these plates. Now, going back to that wait station, I squatted down next to that heaping pile of plates, and I used all of my young leg and back muscles to lift that tray and heft it up to a balance point on my shoulder and one arm. I carefully navigated my way from the remote corner of the restaurant to the dishwashing station. Arriving in the kitchen, I began to use my free hand to attempt to set up a tray stand on which I planned to place that heavy tray. But the flick of my wrist to deploy that tray stand was just the off-balance input that tray needed. I remember watching in horror as in slow motion as I saw the stack of dessert plates on the very edge of the front of the tray slip and then fall off the front. And as those stoneware plates began their descent toward the tile floor, this small shift in weight distribution was enough to cause the barely balanced heavy tray to begin to tip over backwards. I was powerless to stop the inevitable. Dozens of plates met their demise on the merciless hard tile floor below, and the noise, it was astonishingly loud. I was tired. I was sweaty. I was surrounded by sharp, broken, dirty plates on the floor all around me. I began picking up the broken pieces and putting them in the trash can, and it took me quite a while to get through the debris. And only one or two plates was salvageable from the entire stack. And about the time that I had completed picking up about 75% of the mess from the floor, I heard the office door shut. I knew my manager was on her way to discuss with me what had happened. And I knew I was in big trouble. I had made a very foolish choice, and I had been solely responsible for hundreds of dollars in destroyed plates. Now, that particular night, the manager who was on duty, she was one that I particularly liked, and I wasn't sure that she'd still like me after what I had done. Now, I don't know whether she had studied Dale Carnegie's material, but as she approached me, she asked, "Did what I think just happened happen?" I was too scared to speak. I nodded. what was about to happen. She had me dead to rights. There was no escaping. There was no excusing what I had done. What would she do? Would I lose my job? Would she ask me to pay for all those plates? She looked at me and said quietly and firmly, "Let's not let that happen again, okay?" And then she turned and she left. I never heard anything more from her about it again. I was stunned. In that moment, her mercy toward me was amazing, and I was grateful. She did not approach me with a spirit of criticism, although she would have been well within her rights to do so. How do you think that affected my opinion of her? What do you think happened to me the next time? What do you think happened the next time she asked me to do something? I can tell you that for the rest of the time I worked for her, I was always grateful for her kindness. I knew how stupid I'd been, and I knew the consequences to the company, and being yelled at, which every other manager would have rapidly done, would not have had the same impact as her quiet comments. She showed me kindness when I definitely needed it, and I have never forgotten that moment or how I felt when it happened. Kindness over criticism. It's incredibly effective. Remember what Schwab said, that people do better work and put forth greater effort under a spirit of approval? So what can we do to create a spirit of approval? We want to look for ways to catch them doing something right. And I want to point out this on purpose here. It's not enough to see it and acknowledge it was right in your mind. You need to say it out loud. Say it out loud. Be specific. Be clear. Be vocal. That's what Carnegie talks about in his book. And it's what Ken Blanchard talks about in his book, Whale Done. Blanchard notes that when it comes to training the whales at SeaWorld, the trainers ignore all negative behaviors and praise and reward all positive ones. Time-tested, this positivity approach works with these amazing ocean mammals, and it works with the human animal, too. What can you do to catch people doing something right? How can you begin to notice the good things they're already doing? How can you recognize and appreciate them for their contributions, no matter how small those contributions may appear to be at the time? It requires you make it a priority to look for them doing something right, not doing it wrong. And when you see something, say something. Bob Berg says, all things being equal, people do business with people they know, like, and trust. It's not that you have to be liked. It's just that it makes everything easier when people do like you. Now, I don't have at my command the time to teach this in depth during this lesson, but I just want to quickly go over 6 ways to make a connection with your team members. Carnegie says, 1, be genuinely interested in the other person. Be genuinely interested in other people. Number 2, smile. Number 3, remember that a man's name is to him the sweetest and most important sound in any language. A person's name is to that person the sweetest and most important sound in any language. Number 4, be a good listener. Encourage others to talk about themselves. Be a good listener. Encourage others to talk about themselves. Number 5, talk in terms of the other man's interest. Talk in terms of the other person's interest, not your own. And number 6, make the other person feel important and do that sincerely. Make the other person feel important and do that sincerely. Now, of those 6, I want to take a moment to talk about number 6 because I think it ties in very nicely with the Charles Schwab quotes I've shared. How in the world can we help the other person feel important? Now, I have never met anyone who would admit that they get up in the morning and they seek to do lousy work and set a goal of making people angry. And yet we find ourselves feeling like that's exactly what the other person's intending to do. But if you realize that nobody starts out with a goal to be bad at their job or to intend to make you mad, it can help you start to look for the good things that they are doing. Mary Kay Ash, the founder of Mary Kay Cosmetics, said, pretend every single person you meet has a sign around their neck that says, make me feel important. Not only will you succeed in sales, you will succeed in life. Even the most unimportant person can be important to your business. I want to close this lesson with a story about Bob and the impact one conversation had on a business. Ron Burley told this story in Inc. magazine. Ron says, in business, we're often all about the numbers, occasionally to a fault. I'm not saying statistics and metrics aren't useful tools. Sometimes, however, the success or failure of an enterprise comes down to individual interactions, say a handshake or a phone call. Let me give you an example. In 1995, I bootstrapped a tech company, Broadcast Software. We created digital audio and automation software for broadcast radio stations. After 4 years, we had 16 employees and customers in 40 countries. But we were at a transition point. If companies need to grow or die, we were in need of a transfusion. We had grown beyond my ability to fund future growth out of my back pocket, and it was time to get outside capital. But it also turned out to be the time when the tech bubble burst. Our potential funding sources immediately disappeared. I was a hands-on CEO. I had written the original software, and I knew many of our customers personally. I told my employees the buck stopped with me, and I'd be willing to speak with any customer they couldn't help or satisfy. If need be, they should even give out my personal cell number. So, when my cell phone vibrated at 2 a.m. on a Sunday morning, I recognized the 618 area code as Southern Illinois. That meant the caller was Bob, a crusty old-time radio engineer and the owner of a very small rural radio station near Mount Vernon. He purchased one of our systems several months before, and he'd been struggling to get it up and running. Bob's biggest problem is he had never, ever used a computer before. My support manager more than once recommended we just refund Bob's money. We'd marketed our products as easy to use, so we couldn't abandon someone who found our products not easy to use. So I climbed out of bed, I closed the door behind me, and I spent the next 2 hours coaching Bob on how to configure startup options for Microsoft Windows. It wasn't an issue with our software, but it was a problem for our customer, Bob, which made it my problem. At the end of the conversation, I thought we'd made a lot of progress. Bob was enthusiastic, and I was hopeful. And that was the last time anyone heard from Bob. He didn't call tech support. He didn't call me. As time passed, I wondered whether we'd actually fixed the problem or if he'd just given up. I made a mental note to check on him as soon as I figured out the bigger financial issues. But one situation was about to solve the other. Almost 6 months to the day after I'd hung up the phone with Bob, I received another phone call. The chief of engineering of a major media company informed me the company had decided to standardize on our software across its entire chain of more than 300 radio stations. It would be the biggest order in our history, more than $4 million, and it would easily provide all the capital we were needing. This call was a complete surprise. We had not pursued their business. In fact, it had been public knowledge they were selecting one of our competitors. As it turned out, the reason for their mid-course change was Bob. That phone call with Bob saved our company. He had not given up on us. He loved us. Shortly after my call with him, the same media giant made an offer he shouldn't refuse to purchase his radio station. Bob had stayed on as a consulting engineer. And not long after that happened, the company meeting centered on their intentions to purchase the competition's products. Bob raised his hand from the back of the room. "Have you ever heard of Broadcast Software?" He told his new colleagues the story of our phone call and how we had stuck with him for months, even when the problems weren't really our problems. Over lunch and then dinner, Bob sang our praises. At the end of the evening, he scribbled our website and contact info on a cocktail napkin and handed it to their chief of engineering. "Check these guys out," he said. "They are great." They did, and the rest was history, our history. There's a moral to this story. Every customer needs to be treated with respect, and no customer should be left dissatisfied. I'm not saying every customer call is critically important, but some of them certainly are, and you don't know which one might be your Bob. Ron had made Bob feel important, important enough for a two-hour phone call from 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. to solve a problem he was having and help him get through it. All right, it's time for your personal action plan, and let me just review what we talked about in today's lesson. First, why can't people do their dang job? Charles Schwab said, "I have yet to find the person who did not do better work and put forth greater effort under a spirit of approval than under a spirit of criticism." Human connection is the heart of all productive work. The people are the work. We have to remember the people are the work. When we take care of the people, the tasks, they take care of themselves. Kindness is one way to establish loyalty in your people. It builds relationships, and it helps them feel cared for. That restaurant manager instilled a deep loyalty in me, and I've never forgotten how she made me feel. Can you catch them doing something right? When you do, can you say it out loud? We talked through six ways to make people like you, and one of them is to make the other person feel important and to do that sincerely. And that's what Ron did with Bob, and it won him a $4 million contract. Now, for your action plan, what can you apply or change or teach? Think through this. Make it your intent to do something with this information. Now, you might be interested in learning more. I've got a 4-session mastermind coaching package on John Maxwell's book called Relationships 101. It encapsulates this book and program, encapsulates John's philosophy about people. And that's the philosophy that inspired me to become a better team member and a better leader. Now, the cost is $249 a person. And in these 4 sessions, you'll dive into the core of relationships, and that can propel your work forward. It's a don't-miss program filled with practical ideas you can put into use immediately. If you're interested, drop me an email, tom@brighthillgroup.com, and we'll get it set up. Thanks for being here for today's Lead Yourself First lesson, and I look forward to hearing from you next time.